Hello, this is Phil Tomczak, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 21st issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And let's start with some front-page stories from the Star today. The first has the headline, from Federal Politics, Premiers Divided as Carney Pushes to Close Trump Trade Deal That Keeps Tariffs in Place. And this comes from Stephanie Taylor, the Ottawa Bureau, and Tonda McCharles, the Ottawa Bureau Chief. Ottawa. Canada's premiers were split Thursday over a looming trade deal with the United States that would leave damaging tariffs in place, as the Carney government sought to convince a divided provincial front that accepting painful concessions now is preferable to a far more disruptive rupture with Washington. As Prime Minister Mark Carney sought to land the tentative trade deal with U.S. President Donald Trump, he faced a two-front trade war. The first battleground is in Washington, where Canadian negotiators met for hours with American counterparts to finalize what the leaders say is an impending agreement with one day to go before a reprieve that Trump granted on new 50% tariffs expires. At stake, Carney's officials say, is also the future renegotiation of the Canada-U.S.-Mexico deal that covers about 85% of Canada's cross-border trade. The other battleground is in Canada, where Carney faces the task of ensuring premiers agree to fulfill one of the central demands of the Trump administration, returning U.S. alcohol to provincial liquor store shelves. Ontario's Doug Ford and BC's David Eby were conspicuously silent Thursday on their decisions, awaiting more detail on what Canada is giving up in return for accepting lower but still harsh tariff levels on major sectors like steel, aluminum, and autos, while Manitoba's Wab Kinew vented his frustration. Kinew said the Prime Minister made clear there would be no trade deal without provinces agreeing to lift their American alcohol sales bans. I wouldn't say that he was begging us, Kinew said, but what is the step before begging? A description that Nova Scotia's Premier Tim Houston disagreed with as he expressed confidence in Carney. Manitoba may bring back U.S. alcohol, but the Premier urged consumers not to buy it, as he questioned the wisdom of conceding on the booze bans, only to lose leverage before any as-yet-unscheduled CUSMA talks without seeing tariffs eliminated. I just wonder if accepting the idea that Trump tariffs are here forever is the move where we wanted to give up some of that leverage that we've had up to now, said Kinew, pointing to economic and global pressures on Trump's administration ahead of U.S. midterm elections. I think we should fight, he said. I think Donald Trump is very weak. Throughout the day, Carney, whose office issued no public itinerary, worked the phones. He dispatched PMO Chief of Staff Marc-Andre Blanchard to Washington with Canada-U.S. Trade Minister Dominic LeBlanc. The Prime Minister also addressed Liberal Caucus, offering few details, in a virtual meeting with LeBlanc, who was on the line at 11 a.m. from Washington. Carney also only stayed for a short time before having to jump on another call. The message delivered to caucus was one that Canada would only sign a deal that was in the country's economic interest, one Liberal MP said, with another adding that minimal information was shared, given the ongoing nature of the talks. Let's move on to our next story related to the tariff issue. I'm from the world of business, and it has the headline, a 15% U.S. tariff on Canadian-made cars could still crush auto sector, experts say. And this was written by Josh Rubin, business reporter for The Star. A 15% tariff on Canadian-made cars entering the U.S. would still be a major problem for this country's automotive sector, even if it's better than what we've been threatened with, industry analysts say. According to reports from several U.S. publications, the U.S. has agreed to cut the tariff on Canadian-made cars from the current 25% to 15% as part of a tentative trade deal this week. The bigger problem, experts say, is that the tariff would likely apply to all non-U.S. content, including Canadian-made parts. That means the effective tariff rate would still be anywhere from 7 to 8%, said McMaster University engineering professor Greg Mordew, a former senior executive with Toyota Canada. It might be better than 25, but the reality is that 15% is problematic. That's still effectively 7 or 8%, give or take, said Mordew, who noted that's roughly the same percentage of a car's final cost as labor at an assembly plant. No automaker is going to look at that and say, we're going to pay for labor twice. They'd be looking at it and wondering, why are we still in Canada? Applying the tariff only to parts which aren't compliant with the Canada-US-Mexico Agreement on Trade's Rules of Origin, meaning Canadian and Mexican parts wouldn't be tariffed, would make a much bigger difference. Why a lower tariff won't reduce danger to Canada's auto sector. That would bring the effective tariff on most cars made here down to almost zero, Mordew said. Jim Stanford, chief economist at the Center for Future Work, said the lower rate doesn't change the danger. Any incremental change in the rate is helpful, but this is absolutely still an existential threat to investment in the Canadian auto sector in the long run, said Stanford, who was formerly an economist with Unifor's predecessor union, Canadian Auto Workers. This is still very bad. In no way can this be called a victory or a sustainable solution for Canada's auto industry. Even if the official rate gets knocked a few percentage points lower than 15, Stanford said the tariffs imposed by Trump would still crush investment in the Canadian automotive industry. Even reducing it a bit is not going to change the problem, said Stanford. This is still a game changer. We'll move on to our next story. If you'd like to hear the rest of this story, we would be happy to read it to you. So just call the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 716-821-5555. We'd be happy to do that for you. And more local Toronto news in the world of politics. It has the headline, former city councillor Mary Fragadakis announces a run for the Toronto Danforth Council seat. And this is written by Madis Habibinia, City Hall Bureau. Former City Councillor Mary Fragadakis, who was beaten by current Councillor Paula Fletcher in Toronto Danforth in the 2018 election, has decided to run again in the wake of Fletcher's retirement announcement this week. Fragadakis said she believes the last 8 years working as the executive director of the City Place and Fort York BIA, as well as the Lawrence Ingram Keel BIA, have taught her how to manage local economies and prepared her to return as a more experienced councillor. I see every day what's working in the city, what isn't, and where the gap is between city policy and the implementation, said Fragadakis in an exclusive interview with the Star on Thursday. She said she plans to register Friday morning. Fragadakis called herself a progressive, but also practical. I've lived in Toronto Danforth my entire life, and I've had the privilege of representing this community for 8 years, she continued, but I have never really left public service, and so I have the experience to actually hit the ground running. Fragadakis declined to comment on questions about the Taste of the Danforth Festival, which was in a hiatus for a couple of years due to funding shortfalls before it was revived this summer. Fragadakis, also the Greektown BIA's former executive director, was elected to Ward 29, Toronto Danforth, in 2010 with the endorsement of the late NDP leader Jack Layton. She was re-elected in 2014 with a large plurality. During her term, Fragadakis was a TTC board member where she advocated for the transit agency's two-hour transfer policy. She was also on council's Economic and Community Development Committee. Transit's really important to me, Fragadakis said, adding that fighting for affordability is also a priority. The economy is really important. Small business pressures, downtown recovery, infrastructure, the changing nature of work, those kinds of things are what I would be interested in. During the 2018 civic election, Premier Doug Ford cut the number of council seats by almost half, merging city wards to match federal and provincial ridings. The merging of wards 29 and 30 into a single Toronto-Danforth pitted the two incumbents against each other, Fragadakis against fellow progressive Fletcher. After her defeat, the Ontario Liberal Party named Fragadakis as its official candidate for the Toronto-Danforth riding in the 2022 provincial election. Fragadakis lost to NDP MPP Peter Tabuns, who told the Star on Thursday he's endorsing former Toronto school trustee Sarah Earhart for the ward's council seat in this fall's election. Fletcher stunned City Hall on Wednesday with a snap retirement decision, just a couple days after registering for her sixth term following 23 years at City Hall, a change of heart first reported by the Star. A few hours later, Earhart told the Star she hopes to succeed her mentor and registered to run for Fletcher's seat on Thursday morning. Five other candidates were, as of Wednesday, registered to run in Toronto-Danforth: Susan Chappelle, Dennis Corcoran, Jason Stevens, Denise Walcott, and Michael Mitchell. And our next front page story in the world of politics, but it has the headline, "License Plate Readers Have Sparked Outrage in the U.S. Now they're being installed across Canada." And this is written by Alan Woods, staff reporter for The Star. Brampton Mayor Patrick Brown recently celebrated the installation of a network of powerful police surveillance cameras capable of scooping up personal data from unsuspecting drivers. Automated license plate recognition, or ALPR, systems at 50 intersections would make the city, in Brown's words, the safest place to call home and the most inconvenient place in Canada for organized crime to operate. And he said they had overwhelming support from participants in a telephone town hall. But in the U.S., the same AI-driven technology has become a scourge. The cameras, which capture and analyze images of vehicle license plates and other characteristics in search of suspended drivers, stolen cars, and wanted criminals, have been cut down and vandalized. Meant as a public safety balm, they've become a source of public backlash against mass surveillance and police privacy violations after revelations that data from the cameras has been used to track and deport undocumented migrants and to illegally monitor the movements of romantic partners. The American anger hasn't been matched yet in Canada. Despite Premier Doug Ford's decision 1 year ago to ban speed cameras, and the repeated vandalism of Toronto's Parkside Drive camera, there has been little public debate about the adoption and installation of ALPRs. South of the border, much of the criticism has focused on flock safety, which, according to DFLOC, produces most of the ALPR cameras used by U.S. police agencies. DFLOC has mapped more than 128,000 license plate readers across the country. "That is one of the cultural differences between Canada and the United States," said Sarmad Rafi, a data science student at the University of Western Ontario. "For better or worse, they are more interested in the notion of preserving their rights or liberty." Bring the U.S. debate to Canada. Rafi is trying to spark a public awakening about ALPR cameras ahead of Ontario's municipal elections in October by mapping what looks to some like a burgeoning high-tech police state. In June, he launched a website, panopti.ca, as a Canadian version of the DFLOC movement. So far, more than 600 ALPR cameras have been plotted on the map. The majority appear to be in Ontario, the possible result of a 2022 decision by the Ford government to scrap license plate registration stickers and give police a one-time $40 million grant to purchase their own license plate recognition systems. The technology, already widely used by private companies and municipalities for parking enforcement, is increasingly being deployed as a crime-fighting tool. But privacy advocates in Canada say the growing use of license plate readers raises the risk of misuse and could violate the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. If we have one ALPR in one location that can tell you about people who are coming and going, said Aislinn Jackson, policy staff counsel with the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, but if you have a network across the city, you can track one particular car as it moves through the city and get a lot of information, potentially, about the activities of the person who owns that vehicle or the persons who are in that vehicle. Expanded police surveillance can also make people think twice before expressing themselves, joining a protest, or freely going about their everyday lives. When we know we have surveillance devices and we don't know what they do, that exerts a disproportionate chilling effect, Jackson said. The more transparent we can be about what data we're collecting and why, and the more institutions behave in a way that demonstrates they can be trusted to color in the lines that they've set for themselves, the less the chilling effect is going to be. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Let's move on to more news from the GTA, and we have the headline, BTS Boulevard signs are going up in North York ahead of the K-pop group's sold-out Toronto shows. And this is written by Joshua Smith, staff reporter for the Star. New street signs on Yonge Street in North York may not be lighting it up like dynamite, but they are celebrating the upcoming sold-out BTS shows in Toronto this weekend. The city installed a BTS Boulevard sign above the standard signage at the intersection near the Empress Walk Mall Thursday morning, one of many that will be added along a stretch of Yonge to honor the Korean pop group. BTS will perform at Rogers Stadium on Saturday and Sunday as part of the Arirang Tour, the world's most popular boy band's first full group concert series since all seven members took a pause in 2022 to fulfill their mandatory duties of serving in the South Korean military. Toronto City Councilors introduced a motion last month to install temporary signs on Yonge Street from North York Boulevard to Finch Avenue, renaming that stretch BTS Boulevard in honor of the group visiting in late August. The motion also called for the Toronto sign at Nathan Phillips Square to be lit purple on August 22nd and 23rd. The unveiling for the street signs will take place Friday at 10:30 a.m. at North York Boulevard and Yonge Street on the northwest corner, a spokesperson for Councillor Lily Chang said. Chang introduced the motion to put up the signs in July. The BTS Boulevard signs will be up for about a month until September 23rd. BTS will make its Toronto debut this weekend, nearly 8 years after playing three sold-out shows in Hamilton. The City of Toronto erected temporary street signs for Taylor Swift when she came to town during the Eras Tour in 2024. Portions of Queen Street West, John Street, Front Street, and Blue Jays Way were briefly designated Taylor Swift Way. Now let's move on to, let's talk some Maple Leafs. And this one has the headline, Chaconomics, inside the Maple Leafs' massive front office purge under John Chayka. Written by Kevin McGran, our sports reporter. It's a truism in sports that when there's a new guy in the big chair, he'll want to be surrounded by his own people. So the massive changes to the Maple Leafs front office over the summer that followed the hiring of John Chayka as general manager and Matt Sundin as senior executive advisor come as no surprise, really. It's not that different than politics, said Neil Smith, a former NHL GM who hosts the NHL Wraparound podcast. When the new president comes in, everybody from the old president is gone. Brendan Shanahan was a year in as Leafs president on April 12, 2015, when 21 people lost their jobs, including GM Dave Nonis and coach Peter Horacek, as part of what became known as the Shanna Plan. There's no nickname yet for what Chayka is doing. How about Chayconomics? but he has moved much faster than Shanahan. Hired May 3rd, he fired coach Craig Berube just 10 days later. By July 10th, many executives who had been synonymous with the Shanaplan era, including assistant GMs Brandon Pridham and Haley Wickenheiser, were gone. The Star counted 35 names from last year's staff directory of 130 who are no longer listed, more than a quarter of the front office and support staff. Chaka had nothing to do with some of them, including GM Brad Treliving, fired on March 30th, assistant coach Mark Savard, fired mid-season, and senior advisor Cliff Fletcher, who died on June 5th. Some others went by choice. Jennifer Riedenbach, for example, left media relations for a better opportunity at Tennis Canada. Only the 12-person medical staff and equipment staff of five were spared the summertime purge. In the end, the Leafs are a little leaner with just two assistant GMs, down from five. Many positions have been refilled or will be, although the titles may not be the same. "It's unfathomable to me, this whole Leaf thing," said Smith. "I've been very surprised at a lot of the things they've done. But if you scratch the surface, Chaka is not doing anything conventionally. He's not doing anything for brownie points. He's charting his own course. He's doing it his way." What makes Chaka's approach unique? Typically, a new GM will bring in people he knows and trusts. Treliving brought assistant GM Derek Clancy from Calgary, where they'd spent time together. That doesn't seem to be the way Chaka's operating. He's already considered an outsider who ran the former Arizona Coyotes from 2016 to 2020 before he quit and was later suspended by the NHL for conduct detrimental to the league. He hadn't been part of the NHL since then. Some of his hires, such as Jeremiah Crow as director of player personnel, had no previous connection and expressed surprise when they got the call. If guys are getting called out of the blue, he's not going to be doing his reconnaissance, and if he's doing that, then good on him, said Smith. Too many times, GMs will only go and hire their buddies, people that won't threaten their position. Even hiring head coach Jim Hiller, despite being a former bench boss of the Los Angeles Kings and assistant in Toronto, he wasn't on any pundit's list after Berube was fired, feels outside the box. Ex-Vegas Golden Knights head coach, Bruce Cassidy, for example, was high on most lists. "We could have guessed forever, and we wouldn't have come up with Jim Hiller," said Smith. His L.A. experience, none of that was overwhelmingly positive. But, to be fair, you've got to give Jim Hiller a chance. The same can be said for Chaka and his moves to date. "He's not doing it to win a popularity contest," said Smith. "A lot of people make their decisions based on popularity. He's not doing that. Credit to him for that. He's doing what he thinks is right, not what everybody else thinks is right." Let's move on to our next story now from the world of food and drink. In our headline, "I can't stop thinking about Toronto's best $7 soft serve on Dundas West." This is written by Karen Liu, food reporter. SuperServe's Tahini Coffee soft serve with milk crumble and cornflake and pretzel crunch is $7, located at 562 Dundas Street West. Well, the dish. Start with SuperServe's Coffee Tahini Twist, $5.50 for a cup or cone, $1 extra for a waffle cone. A harmonious combination of Hatch Coffee and tahini, created by manager, baker, and recipe developer Sidney Mountfort. There's an undertone of earthy, bittersweet nuttiness that settles on the tongue after the initial hit of sugar. Despite being dairy-free, all of Mountfort's seasonal creations are vegan, the soft serve has a luxe texture from a blend of rice and coconut milks. You don't taste either. For toppings, Mountfort and I came up with a combination of milk crumble, a shortbread cookie crumble made with milk powder and white chocolate, and cornflake and pretzel crunch. Toppings are 75 cents each. The milk crumble mellows the coffee, while the cornflake and pretzel crunch adds a savory, crispy contrast and a subtle peanut butter finish to the tahini. Super Serves, two soft serve machines aimed to please everyone. One is devoted to classic chocolate and vanilla dairy soft serve for purists, while the other is reserved for Mountfort's seasonal creations. As if she doesn't already wear enough hats, she's also a university student. The restaurant. Shortly after I wrote about eight of my favorite soft serve places in the city, readers recommended I also check out Super Serve, a 3-year-old seasonal shop. Soft serve is a really interesting medium for putting flavors together, said co-owner Owen Walker, who first came to prominence as a bartender. Similar to a cocktail, you need balance and body in soft serve. What flavorings and toppings you can add to give dimension. You can add a fresh Ontario raspberry compote, add acidity to the depth and bitterness of tahini and coffee. As for the new fashion hairstylist sign out front, it's a tribute to the hair salon that used to be there, as well as its late owner, who also used to own the building. He was truly the sweetest guy. He was known as the Perm King, said Walker, who is also a partner at perpetually popular spots such as Pizzeria Badiali and Quetzal, as well as the just-opened French restaurant Les Incompetents in St. Catharines. But what else is on the menu? The underrated hit at SuperServe is the Super Cookie Sundae, $7.95, which is worth ordering for Mountfort's cookie alone. Two generously sized cookies with gooey, brownie-like centers sandwich a swirl of vanilla soft serve drizzled with salted caramel. We use Calabout darkened milk chocolate chips, and the inside is very fudgy because we use a lot of egg yolks and powdered sugar that makes it custardy in the middle and super crunchy on the outside, so you always have that fresh baked texture, she said. A light dusting of salt flakes on the cookie rounds out the sundae, balancing the caramel sauce. The aforementioned raspberry compote is best enjoyed in the vegan Feature Super Serve Sundae, $7.95, which consists of the coffee tahini soft serve twist finished with two little brownie bites. Explore the area. This is a prime foodie starting point. Directly north is Kensington Market, where I still like to get groceries. Global Cheese at 76 Kensington Avenue, Sanigan's Meat Locker, 176 Baldwin Street, be sure to pick up some $3 sausage rolls, and Blackbird Baking Company, 172 Baldwin Street, are an essential holy trio for summer picnics. If you're still in a soft-serve state of mind, head to Sonny's Chinese at 60 Kensington Avenue, which just started serving Ontario Corn Soft Serve. Head west towards Bathurst for the Market 707 Shipping Container Food Market. For Omosubi Bar Suzumi's seasonal Japanese rice balls, a sure bet in our top 100 under $100 guide. And Nom 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 Poutine for the closest thing to getting your gravy and cruds from a roadside stop in Quebec. In the other direction is Chinatown, where New Sky Restaurant's new and expanded dining room at 444 Spadina Avenue has a separate chifa menu specializing in Peruvian Chinese cuisine. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Let's talk entertainment now in the world of movies. We have an article, Coyote vs. Acme is one of the year's funniest movies, but it almost didn't make it to the screen. Written by Peter Howell as a special to the Star. Coyote vs. Acme, one of the year's funniest movies, was nearly pushed off a cliff before audiences got the chance to see it. Warner Brothers Discovery planned to ixnay director Dave Green's live-action animated comedy as a tax write-off, despite its reported $70 million U.S. cost. Originally scheduled for the July 2023 weekend, later claimed by the studio's Barbie, it was shelved amid fears moviegoers would reject its hybrid of madcap cartoon comedy and human courtroom drama. After a public and industry outcry, indie distributor Ketchup Entertainment acquired worldwide rights, The film will be released throughout North America on August 28th, 3 years later than originally planned. That's a real happy ending, not merely for this movie, but for Hollywood. Studios too often treat an unconventional or commercially uncertain film as disposable. Yet, cinema history is full of projects, among them the Kubrick-Spielberg collaboration, AI, Artificial Intelligence, and David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, that were rejected, delayed, or abandoned before being reclaimed as enduring achievements. Coyote vs. Acme makes its case for existence with a riotous plot about hapless roadrunner chaser Wile E. Coyote. With assistance from his earnest lawyer, Kevin Avery, played by Will Forte, he's suing Acme Corporation after suffering decades of pain from its defective rockets, anvils, and other tools that have repeatedly backfired in his pursuit of the Speedy Bird. The film is a satirical missile aimed at corporate greed and corruption, especially apt targets these days, given WBD's own well-publicized boardroom battle. Netflix sought to acquire WBD's studios and streaming operations, but not its linear TV networks. Paramount Skydance, by contrast, won with a bid for the entire company and all of its assets. The fates of Batgirl, Artificial, and Gore. Not every abandoned movie deserves to be rescued, but a studio's cold feet shouldn't automatically drop an anvil onto a completed or nearly completed film. Batgirl is a glaring example of this unfortunate trend. The DC Comics superhero movie, directed by Adil El Arbi and Bilal Fallah, stars Leslie Grace as the titular hero, Michael Keaton as Batman, and Brendan Fraser as the villain Firefly. The nearly finished film was supposed to open in late 2022, but WBD chief David Zaslav killed it outright without allowing another company to buy it. We're not going to release a movie unless we believe in it. Our job is to protect the DC brand, Zaslav said. He didn't elaborate on what protecting the DC brand entails. One has to wonder whether considerations beyond quality affected the decision. That seems to be the case with Artificial, an Amazon MGM-backed production directed by Luca Guadagnino, Call Me By Your Name and Challengers, that was expected to be front and center at film festivals this fall, including next month's Toronto International Film Festival. It's a presumably unflattering biopic of the struggles of Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, during the corporate jousting following his company's 2022 release of ChatGPT, the generative AI chatbot that, for many people, was their introduction to artificial intelligence. Starring Andrew Garfield as Altman and Monica Barbaro and Cooper Hoffman in other key roles, Artificial would have been a hot ticket at any fest. But Amazon abruptly dropped the film shortly after it announced an investment of up to $50 billion in OpenAI. Amazon claimed the film would be better served at another studio, but the timing inevitably raised questions about whether corporate considerations, rather than the film's merits, shaped Amazon's decision. We will still see Artificial, but not on the fall festival circuit. It's been picked up by Neon, which has punted it into the frozen early months of 2027, with possibly a brief Oscar qualifying run in late December. There's no such consolation prize for Gore, Michael Hoffman's biopic of the late Gore Vidal, an American writer of rapier wit and vivid imagination. With two-time Oscar winner Kevin Spacey in the title role, the $40 million Netflix film was nearly completed in 2017 when allegations of sexual misconduct against its star emerged, allegations he denied. Netflix paused production while the legal cases unfolded. Spacey was acquitted of all 9 UK criminal sex offense charges in 2023 and found not liable in complainant Anthony Rapp's civil lawsuit, while 3 UK civil claims were confidentially settled out of court in 2026. Separate US cases were dismissed, declined for prosecution, or ended on procedural grounds. yet Netflix did not resume production or release Gore. The film remains in limbo, adding to the ignominy Spacey felt when Netflix dropped him from its hit political series, House of Cards, and Ridley Scott removed him from All the Money in the World and recast Christopher Plummer in the role of J. Paul Getty. Whatever moviegoers conclude about Spacey, the fate of a nearly completed film also involves the work of its director, writers, crew, and fellow performers. TriStar Sony may have had good reasons to walk away, but permanent burial leaves no room for audiences or another distributor to make their own judgment. The strangling of Batgirl and Gore in their cradles and near execution of Coyote vs. Acme suggest Hollywood needs stronger limits on the use of tax write-downs to bury films for reasons that have little to do with artistic or production catastrophe. Well, let's change course now. Let's move on to relationships and Ask Lisi. And this is advice columnist Lisi Tesher. And today's headline, "My husband went away without me. In every photo, there are two young women hanging on him. Is he lying? Let's ask Lisi." And here is the reader question. "My husband went on a family vacation for a week with his siblings and their parents, no partners or kids, on a bucket list adventure that his mother always wanted to do. She's unfortunately unwell and probably doesn't have much longer. It was simpler for them to go, just the six of them, and expensive. We have an infant and another brother has a pregnant wife, and this wasn't the trip for us anyway, so we partners were all happy for them to go. However, in almost every photo, there are two young women hanging on to my husband and one of his brothers, and I'm not happy about it. Supposedly, these two girls were working at the resort they were at and were assigned to the family for their adventure. How do I believe my husband that they were just employees when they are in every pic, literally draped all over him? I feel sick about it. Signed, Holiday Hussey." And here's Lisi's answer. "I don't know anything about your relationship with your husband prior to this trip, but if you have reason to distrust him, then you need to trust him. But if you have no reason to distrust him, then you need to trust him. However, if you are already distrusting for whatever reason, then you have bigger fish to fry. I suggest you sit down with your husband and talk about your feelings. If that doesn't prove successful, I strongly suggest you two see a marriage counselor to discuss what's going on. Unfortunately, things happen. Even if you thought you had a great marriage and had absolutely no reason to distrust your husband, he may have behaved inappropriately. You could talk to his siblings, depending on the relationship you have with them, but I think you two should talk first and foremost." And now our next letter from our next reader. And here's the question. "Years ago, when we were in college, I had a fling with my roommate's brother. It was super hot and sexy because we knew she would hate us both if she ever found out. We were young and neither of us was looking for a relationship. But fun sex was what we had and lots of it. We bump into each other here and there, and when we do, there's always a twinkle in his eye and a smile on my lips. No one has ever said anything to either of us. Recently, I heard that he and his fiance broke up. Apparently, she was double-dipping and had another boyfriend that he obviously knew nothing about. She couldn't go through with the wedding, so got sloppy with her secrecy, and he caught her. She faked a whole story. But then the truth emerged. My old roommate told me her brother was really shaken by the whole thing. And then he and I bumped into each other while out walking our dogs. We walked and talked, and I invited him back to my place to talk some more, and you guessed it, we fell into bed together and had the best night ever. Do we have to keep this a secret from his sister, or can we just be who we want to be? Signed, Twinkle Twinkle." And Lisi's answer. "The answer depends on you two and not on his sister, your old roommate. Does he want to have casual sex with you openly? Are you two going to date or just fulfill each other's needs?
I would say let it play out naturally. If he calls his sister right away, let him, as long as you don't care. But why should you? You're adults, I assume, since he was engaged, and you can live your lives as you see fit. Enjoy each other. Let's move on to our next lifestyle article. You know, this is actually news from British Columbia, and it has the headline, BC vet warns of a surge in bat encounters after positive rabies test. And this is written by Nono Shen of the Canadian Press. A veterinarian is warning of a surge in encounters with bats in British Columbia's Sea to Sky region after one of the mammals that had direct contact with a human tested positive for rabies. Experts have suggested the spike in bat encounters and sightings could be related to recent wildfires in the province. Jordy Schnarr, a managing veterinarian with Coast Mountain Veterinary Services in Whistler, said a bat was brought in by health officials for testing in mid-July, and results from the Canadian Food Inspection Agency came back positive for the deadly disease. Schnarr said she did not know what happened to the person who came into contact with the bat, and while the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority did not immediately answer questions about the case, there are currently no known cases of human rabies in the province. In 2024, an 11-year-old boy died of rabies in Ontario after he was woken up at a cottage by a bat landing on his mouth, developing tingling, numbness, and swelling on the right side of his face 3 weeks later. She said a medical health officer with the authority recommended that she get 2 rabies boosters, even though she had been vaccinated against the disease multiple times before. Schnarr said the clinic had seen a noticeable increase in reported encounters between bats and pets, with 25 people bringing in pets so far this year, compared with fewer than 5 cases last year. Like 2 days ago, we had 6 in one day, which is certainly an outlier, said Schnarr. So we definitely are seeing an increase in these particular encounters. The tricky part is that the bites from bats sometimes leave no visible evidence due to their tiny teeth, said Schnarr. Even if we are slightly suspicious that there could have been an interaction, we do recommend seeking post-exposure care for those pets, said Schnarr, adding that rabies boosters are recommended for pets within 7 days of exposure. A positive test means the pet must undergo 90 days of isolation and observation. The Whistler case isn't isolated, with Coastland Veterinary Hospital in Campbell River on Vancouver Island warning this week that a bat found in the area tested positive for rabies on July 24th. Campbell River Public Health said rabies remains uncommon in BC, but a single rabies positive bat isn't unusual, as bats are a natural part of our ecosystem and a small number may carry rabies. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And some more local news from the GTA. A headline, a second man, 18, charged in deadly Salsa on St. Clair shooting, appears in court. And written by Sheila Reed, staff reporter. One of the 2 men charged in the deadly shooting at the Salsa on St. Clair festival in July made an appearance in a Toronto court on Thursday morning. Louis Downey, 18, appeared by video from Toronto South Detention Center, where he addressed the Ontario Court of Justice. Downey indicated that he would be represented by criminal defense lawyer Nathan Gorham and is due back in court on September 10th. The Toronto man is one of 2 men accused of fatally shooting Shaquan Kwashi, 25, and Cesar Vernaza, 20, at a Latin street festival on July 11th in what police have said was a targeted attack. 5 others were injured during the shooting, suffering non-life-threatening injuries. Downey and Josiah Massaro Gill, 18, were arrested on August 5th and each charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder and 5 counts of attempted murder. Massaro Gill appeared in court on August 11th and will next appear on August 25th. According to court documents, officers found a loaded Glock 45 handgun at Downey's downtown Toronto apartment, and he was charged with possessing a restricted firearm without a license, in addition to the possession of heroin and cocaine. The arrests were announced by Police Chief Myron Demkew alongside Detective Sergeant Stacy McCabe on August 7th, after weeks of silence from Toronto police following the shooting. I know there have been frustrations that we have not been able to share more information publicly over the past several weeks. That's understandable, Demkew said. But successful investigations require investigators to protect the integrity of the evidence. Authorities have not yet commented on a motive. Reducing incidents like this to simply gang violence oversimplifies a much more complex problem, said McCabe on August 7th. This investigation is about violence and the willingness of young people to use guns with complete disregard for human life and the safety of anyone around them. Salsa on St. Clair drew an estimated 13,000 people to the Midtown location before the shooting sent panicked festival-goers scattering. The two-day event was cut short, sparking a conversation about public safety at summer events in the city. And another news item from the GTA, and our next story, it has the headline, Sick Kids Hit by Cybersecurity Breach Affecting Some Employees' Personal Data, the hospital warns. And this is written by Joshua Smith, staff reporter. A recent cybersecurity breach at the Hospital for Sick Children, also known as Sick Kids, in downtown Toronto, compromised some employee data but didn't expose any patient information, the medical facility said. The breach enabled unauthorized access to personal information of some current and former employees, the hospital wrote in a statement on Thursday. It may have affected the personal information of those who work, or used to work, for Sick Kids, Boomerang, and the Sick Kids Foundation, and also may have affected Sick Kids job applicants, according to the hospital. Sick Kids didn't say how many people were affected. The breach is linked to a vulnerability in a third-party software application used by Sick Kids and other organizations, according to the hospital, which added that clinical systems and patient information were not affected, and patient care has continued as usual. The incident also temporarily affected the facility's external careers website, but that has since been safely restored. Sick Kids launched an investigation and consulted outside cybersecurity experts to support the internal probe into the incident, the hospital said, adding that its review of the affected information is ongoing. Anyone determined to have been affected will be directly notified, but as a precaution, everyone who may have been impacted has been alerted and offered 2 years of free credit monitoring and identity protection services, the hospital said. In 2007, Sick Kids was ordered to encrypt all electronic patient files after a laptop containing health information on 2,900 people was stolen from a van belonging to a doctor at the hospital. Our next article, more from the world of entertainment. What You Said, and it has the headline, A Cineplex Problem. Readers say movie theater manners in Toronto have quietly disappeared. And this is written by Paige Oldfield, digital producer. Star reporter Bianca Thompson recently looked at how Toronto moviegoers are grappling with a return of bad theater etiquette, talking, texting, feet on seats, as blockbusters like Spider-Man and The Odyssey pack GTA theaters again. Readers had a lot to say, and some of it wasn't optimistic, but others have workarounds to share. Here's what was on your minds. These comments have been edited for clarity and length. Whose job is it to fix this? From Kim Didn't Hedge, this is a Cineplex problem, and they need to solve it. There has been more than enough conversation about this for years. It is not my duty as a customer to confront those behaving poorly. Jason, replying to another reader's mention of staff auditorium checks, was skeptical they mean much. It's jarring and disruptive, he said, and entirely for show. They walk in, sign a log sheet, and they walk out. There could be a battle royale going on in the seating section, and they wouldn't bat an eye on their way to the exit. Tom offered some institutional memory, recalling a theater program director's term for chatty patrons. In the theater, they called it living room TV syndrome. People not in venues, just sitting together with family and friends, chat through shows all the time, and had forgotten or never been taught that public conduct expectations are different. Speak up or stay home. Keith argued the fix is simple. So many people complain about these things but do nothing about it. Yes, it's irritating and unnecessary, so speak up, politely. You might be surprised how effective it can be. Rosemarie described doing just that at a Blue Jays game, telling loud talkers behind her, "Wow, I know about your whole family situation now." Mr. Papagiorgio took matters into his own hands when a fellow moviegoer played a movie on his phone with the volume up. The 17-year-old manager, he said, did absolutely nothing, so I had my own little chat with the guy and convinced him to put his phone away. I'm still waiting for my paycheck from Cineplex for doing the manager's job. Solutions that readers actually want. Jerry proposed the most concrete fix. He said, maybe they should start requiring people to put their phones in a locked pouch like they do at some concerts. If you want or need your phone, you have to go out in the hallway to unlock the bag and get your phone. Walter had a bigger ask, dedicated quiet screenings. We may have to bring back the term silent film and repurpose it for screens dedicated to no phones, no talking, in big letters on the doors and back of the seats. Others have found smaller workarounds. Mark said, the best I've been able to come up with is continuing my own COVID-era movie-watching protocols and wait until later in the movie's theatrical run when less people are coming out. Select seats that are away from others if possible. Jane pointed to drive-ins. For people with a vehicle, I recommend a summer experience of going to a drive-in. Closest ones to Toronto are Oakville and Newmarket. It's a bigger problem than the movies. Several readers said the issue isn't really about theaters at all. It's about public behavior generally. Andrew wrote, Torontonians have forgotten how to behave everywhere. Roads, sidewalks, malls, restaurants, libraries, movies. Behavior that is symptomatic of the devolution of civil society, much of it linked to the omnipresence of cell phones. Anne was blunter. Manners and consideration of others when in a group environment is non-existent. I can do what I want, is the new mantra. Irv connected the dots to dining out. I've cut down on eating in restaurants because, inevitably, a fool with a phone will sit next to me and carry on a loud, amplified conversation on speaker. Why would I bother spending money for that experience? Theater and restaurant owners take note. Caroline described a similar disruption at Roy Thompson Hall. I have not been back since before COVID, when a pair of women had their phones out and were texting just as the Toronto Symphony Orchestra was going to begin their performance. The quiet exodus. For a lot of commenters, the simplest solution has been to stop going altogether. Sarah summed up the calculation. I have an 81-inch screen at home. It's good enough for me. Harith said he's grateful he got to enjoy theaters as a kid in a time before smartphones, and now finds movies at home more peaceful and cheaper. We want to hear from you. Have you cut back on going to the movies? What's the last theater experience that pushed you over the edge? And is there anything that we could get you back in the seats? Let us know in the comments section below. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 21st edition of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Phil Tomczak. Thank you for listening.